Hi, my name is Londe Yusuf.
And my name is Reggie Williams.
And we're the co-founders of Black Film Space. Black Film Space is a grassroots organization dedicated to enhancing the skill sets of Black filmmakers and building a community of creatives. We host events such as screenwriting workshops, panels, mixers, and other events that are designed to support Black content creators.
In the next episode of the Black Film Space podcast, we interview Eric Oliver. Eric is an assistant director who has worked on Mixed Dish, Raising Dion, and Being Mary Jane. We talk with Eric about the importance of assistant directors, the role of the first, second, and second AD, the benefits of joining the Directors Guild, and much more. And now, on to our interview. All right, Eric, thank you for joining us on the Black Film Space podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Of course, of course. So I just want to jump right in. Why did you choose to be an assistant director?
Well, I'm not sure. I sort of fell into it, so I don't know that I chose to be one. But once I started doing it, it was something that I enjoyed doing. The diversity of the projects you get to work on, something I enjoyed, the actual tasks of being an AD are tasks that sort of fit right up my alley and were something that was easy for me to do. So I stuck with it.
Gotcha. Gotcha. How did you fall into it?
Shortly after college, my brother had been working in film as a production assistant. He's a couple of years older than I am. And pretty much at his suggestion, there's this program called the DGA training program. If you ever watch credits and you see DGA trainee, that's what that program is. It's basically a paid internship where they assign you to productions. It takes about 2 years to complete. And once you're done with that program, you're then eligible to join the guild, which is what I did. It's not necessarily an easy thing to get into, but if you can get into it, it's a great way. Especially if you have no experience doing anything. You really didn't need experience to do it. So that's sort of how I fell into it at my brother's suggestion.
So, Eric, how would you define the role of a first AD, second AD on a production?
So generally on most productions, the production team, which would be considered the production manager, first AD, second AD, and often days... Now you have a second AD, which is just another of the second ADs. They just split up their responsibilities. First AD is generally responsible for creating the schedule. In pre-production, they'll work with the director, work with the producers, department heads to come up with a schedule that makes sense for everybody, considering all the constraints, budgetary, location-wise, talent availability, all that sort of thing. And then once you actually start shooting, the first AD runs the set while the second AD and additional seconds, second, what have you, will just help maintain all the paperwork and make sure everybody understands what's going on at any given moment.
And what do you mean by run the set?
The whole job starts in prep. And that leads into running the set. In a sense, it's two different jobs when you're doing prep and then once you're shooting.
Okay.
But generally, the first AD is the right-hand person to the director. The AD job, be that first AD, second AD, second, any additional seconds, production assistants, is to make sure the director has all of the elements they need on that particular day at that particular moment to get the shot that's needed. The first AD is kind of at the top of that. And they're the one that's on the set, that's right by the director, that's calling the shots, basically saying, this is what we're going to be doing next. Usually it's with the director's, of course, approval. But for the most part, directors don't try to deal with the logistics of things. That's what the first AD does. So they'll make sure the actors are there when they're supposed to be there. They'll make sure the crew knows what exactly it is we're doing for that first shot. And they'll make sure the crew has everything that we need for that. If there are any effects that are going on, they'll make sure effects is there and ready for that. If there's any special wardrobe that's needed, they'll be there making sure that costumes has the correct wardrobe that they need. And from a minute-to-minute basis, it's the first AD's job to sort of maintain the schedule that they've created in pre-production. So the first AD is the one who's looking at the schedule saying, well, we need to get this done or we won't have time for this. Of course, the director then can say, well, I don't need that, so let's take more time on this. But that's something that the first AD is always keeping in mind. They're always looking at the clock. We figure out certain parameters. If an actor isn't available after a certain time on a certain day, that's something that the first AD is constantly aware of and reminding the director, you're going to lose this person in a certain amount of time.
Do you ever work on productions where any of these roles are merged? Because in indie film, I feel like assistant director and AD, those lines get blurred a lot.
Yeah, and it's kind of a hard thing because there's so much work that ADs need to do in general. It's really hard for one person to do it. So there are shows where you'll have a first AD and a second AD without a second. And it's hard to do a show with less than two ADs because you need somebody on set and you need somebody off set. There's a whole bunch of paperwork that needs to be done, which is generally what second ADs are dealing with. They're dealing with paperwork. They're dealing with making phone calls to cast. They're dealing with what's coming up for the next week. So they're looking at the schedule and preparing for the next week while the first AD is on set, making sure we're getting today's work done. So on certain shows where if it's really small, lots of independent films will do that. And they'll sort of, a lot of indies, I think, underestimate the importance of having that one person, that first AD, who's there, who's making sure that we're getting everything we need and who's pushing us along and pushing the crew along and keeping the crew together and on the same page about everything. When you're directing, that's not something you really should be thinking about or want to be thinking about. You want to be thinking about what's going on in front of the camera. And if you have to think about all the other stuff that's going on behind, it's going to suffer and it's going to show. When you talk about union shows, there are mandated staffing requirements. And if you have a certain number of crew members, you have to have a second assistant director in addition to the first. Sometimes you'll do like small little visual effects units or insert units where you don't have that many cast and it's a really small splinter unit. The first AD really would be able to do that by themselves if it's really small and really contained. But then when you get contractually, when you have a larger crew and a certain number of cast, you actually have to have an additional AD working in there with the first. And it's something that I think most first ADs would want that. Somebody to back them up, somebody to, you know, double check their work. A lot of people, I go on a lot of shows and people don't necessarily understand that all of these schedules that they see generally come from the first AD. And when you're shooting and things are changing as you're shooting and the schedule changes, that's something the first AD needs to keep track of. It needs to change the schedule. If the script changes, they have to go back over their schedule and make sure the elements in the new version of the script are elements that they had in their schedule. And if not, that it needs to be added. So there's so much that the first AD needs to keep track of. It's really hard. Like I keep saying this, but and I keep trying to stress it because I do a lot of advising for student films and smaller productions. And that's one of the things that a lot of people really do miss, having that one person that's keeping track of the schedule and making sure that we're on schedule. Producers will often try to do that, but it's not the same because they have other things to be thinking about and dealing with. They're not standing there on set watching what's going on. They're not familiar with the script as much as normally a first AD would be, and with the elements that are required.
Can you elaborate more on the pre-production process of creating a schedule and what that's like?
Yeah, so I mean, with in any department you're in, the first thing you're going to do when you get on a show is you get a script. Normally, when a first AD comes on, a producer has already put together some sort of schedule. Again, just keep in mind that this is my personal experience. It's different on every show you're going to ever find. And every single AD has a different view of how this whole thing works. But there are some things that are, standard throughout the industry. It changes when you're talking about a feature as opposed to episodic. And those are other differences we can talk about in a little bit. But for the most part, during the pre-production period, the first AD is working with the director, the production designer, production manager, producers, and most of the other department heads to figure out how it can all be put together and shot. If there are any specific locations that need to be done at this period of time, those are all things that the first AD takes in mind and then puts out a schedule, figures out how we're going to shoot this whole thing. Oftentimes when the first AD comes on, there's already some sort of schedule that either production manager or line producers put together. Normally in the process of budgeting, you need to create a schedule just to figure out how, just to make it easier to budget. It's hard to budget if you don't know where you're going to be shooting, how many days you have, and if you don't know how you're going to break that up. So normally a first AD will come in with some sort of schedule that's usually up to them whether they keep it or not. They can start completely from scratch and do a completely new schedule. That whole process in itself is a very esoteric kind of thing, and it changes. And every time you make one decide we're going to do this scene on this day, you'll get some information that says, oh, wait, we can't do that on that day because he needs long hair and we're going to cut his hair afterwards. So there are things in the script that also dictate where in the schedule things can fall. So those are all things the first AD is keeping track of. During pre-production, they're getting extremely familiar with the script, pretty much. So you could pick out a scene in your head if you needed to, and you know where things fall, just to make it easier in scheduling that whole thing. Once they got the script sort of set in their mind, they can then start laying it out. There are different softwares people use. Movie Magic Scheduling is the most common one these days, although I think Celtics has a free version and paid version, which is also a lot of indie films use Celtics for doing their schedules. But whatever it is, you create a strip board from that. And then that's what you're going to use to pass out to the rest of the crew. So everybody knows these are the scenes we're doing on this particular day. These are the elements that are required for that specific day and that specific scene. Is that clear?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, no, that's totally clear. Okay. Yeah.
I'm speaking from, you know, for doing this for over 25 years. So a lot of times it takes me a little bit of time sometimes to realize that everything I'm saying isn't necessarily common knowledge. So if you feel something needs to be expanded on, feel free to let me know.
Of course.
What can production managers, producers, and directors do to make life easier on set for people in your position?
Oh, that's a good question. I think being supportive is the best thing they can do. There's nothing worse than when you need something and you've got a production manager, producer who are constantly questioned. Specific things I'll say, like if you're doing a stunt and you want a paramedic, that's something a first AD might request. And that's something you shouldn't necessarily have to fight for, but oftentimes it is. It helps when production managers and producers are thinking these things through on their own also. And when they're open to your bringing these things up. We didn't discuss that, but generally the first AD is responsible for on-set safety also. So if there's any, and they're responsible for keeping their crew safe. So if there's anything that they need, it helps when producers and production managers are receptive to hearing that and not constantly dismissing things out of hand, which you'll have. And then you might have to go back and make your case, in which case they might come around. But just, I think being supportive of the staff and the team is the best thing they can do. Being communicative, giving the information. There's nothing worse than not having information that you need. And then at the last minute, finding out, well, we're not authorized to shoot in front of this building. I was like, well, wait a minute. We scouted this. Everybody was on the same page, except one of the producers might not have said that because they were thinking, well, we'll get there and we'll look a different way, or I'll tell them on the day. And I've been on shows where that's happened, where the director was expecting to shoot at the entrance of a, you know, where this was in Los Angeles, and I think it was Sony Studios. We were supposed to be shooting at their front gate, and we're there setting up, and the production manager comes and says, we're not actually authorized to be here. And I was like, why not? Because I didn't ask for permission. So we couldn't do it because the production manager didn't ask for permission, knew that he hadn't asked for permission, but didn't want to say anything to anybody for whatever reason. So just making sure everybody's aware of what's going on. Same thing with directors. Directors will often have in their mind something, but without getting it out, nobody else knows what it is that's in their mind. So you could get to set and a director will say, this isn't what I was thinking. And it's like, well, sometimes you have to say what you're thinking, otherwise it won't actually materialize. And that have a lot of new directors will often miss that of just communicating everything that I'm seeing in my mind. And if it's not in the script, at least make sure I'm putting it out there so that everybody can hear it.
Have you ever had to go above the director to, like, I don't know, an executive producer or something about an issue that may have been urgent where the crew wasn't listening to you?
I have not. In my experience, I've never really had to. I mean, there are times when a director wants to do something and you might say to the director, I don't think that's safe. The director will want to do it. And you might have to then get a producer involved. And that's happened. But nothing, you know, it's never usually, but that's sort of the way the hierarchy works. So,
okay.
And it's also, I just want to add, because the assistant director is an interesting position. The first AD is kind of the right-hand person for the director, but they're at the same time working kind of on the producer side. And it gets more like that, especially when you talk about episodic. Again, we're saying episodic and features are different. Oftentimes on features, the director will choose their first AD because they've worked with the person before, they know them, they know how to work together, they can communicate well. When you get to episodic, normally it's the director that's coming in, that's a, you know, day player, if you will, coming in for one episode or two episodes, and the first AD is there for the entire run of the show. So it kind of gets a little bit hazy as to where their allegiance is supposed to lie. Because when you're on an episodic show, you're on the show, and it's kind of, you're, the producers hired you and the producers can fire you. Whereas when you're working just specifically for a director that you've worked with before, producers won't necessarily have that much say. And again, this completely depends on the situation, depends on the director, depends on the show. There are plenty of features where the director doesn't necessarily get to choose their first AD. They might get to approve them because they have to work with them, but they're not the one that's actually choosing them. So it does get a little strange, but that's where I think the allegiances can sort of get a little messy when you're there working for the director to make sure the director gets what they need. But at the same time, you're kind of responsible to the producers who are looking at other things. They're looking at, you know, budgetary things as opposed to whether we get exactly what the director needs. And it's when, in those cases, I think most times the first AD, if there's ever some sort of friction or disagreement about what needs to be done, that's when the producer, you'll say to the producer, this is what they want to do, and kind of step out of it. Because it really isn't, if a director wants to do something, it's usually not up to the first AD to say, yes, you can or no, you can't. That's something a producer would do. So again, it sort of makes it a weird thing if things do happen, but it's not that, I don't know that it's not really been an issue in my experience. Okay.
What is your communication style when you're communicating with the rest of the crew on set?
Communication style, that's direct. I don't know what else to say. Direct, just say, this is what it is, this is what we're doing.
I envision assistant directors maybe not yelling at the crew, but being like, you know,
assertive.
Yeah, being very almost aggressive, you know, to make sure to push the crew to, you know.
That's actually an interesting point, because there are a lot of different theories about how to motivate a crew. And there are plenty of ADs out there that are yellers. Sometimes directors want the AD to be that person because they're not. I don't want to be seen. Mm-hmm. I'm directing. I don't want to be seen as the bad guy. So I'll have a first AD who's sort of an ass, who can, you know, who can be that person that I don't want to be. As far as I'm concerned, I don't think it's a good idea to really yell at anybody. I mean, absolutely know what you're doing, be clear and precise with your directions, but everybody there is doing a job and everybody should know their job. And that's sort of, I think that's what the key is. If everybody knows what their job is and if everybody knows how it relates to what we're doing specifically right now, there should be no problem as far as me getting people to do what they need to do. You know what your job is. I shouldn't have to tell you to do your job. I might have to explain the parameters that we're working under. If there are certain restrictions on this location, I'll explain that to you, but then you know your job, so I shouldn't have to then yell at you or speak to you in an aggressive manner to get you to do what it is you're supposed to do, as long as I'm clear with that. And I find it's the same sort of thing. Some people say, you know, if you're leading the crew with, you know, like as a more in a friendly manner, as opposed to a drill sergeant, it depends on the crew. Some crews need that. Some crews don't. Some crews respond to better to people that are just, you know, spitting out orders like this way, this way, this is what we're doing now, that kind of thing. But I found in my experience, most people don't respond to first ADs that are like that. They respond much better to first ADs that understand it's a collaborative thing. We're all working on this. We know what our job is. Just give us time to do it. I think one of the other things is understanding what all the departments do is a really important thing, and understanding what they're doing for this specific thing. A lot of times you'll find that ADs don't talk to the department heads to find out exactly what it is they need. If they're rigging some sort of effect, how much time do you need to rig this? That's something the first AD should know. It's not something where you get to set and say, okay, how much time do you need? Well, we need a half hour to rig this. Half hour? That's not the time to get pissed off at somebody, because those are things you should have known. And that's part of what goes into scheduling. So if you need a half hour, tell me, and I'll make sure that we're aware of that. Oftentimes, as the first AD, you're trying to figure out if this is going to take longer than we expected to set this up, is there something else we can do instead? So oftentimes, you're not asking somebody to rush them. You're asking to figure out if we should move to something else just to maximize, you know, our efficiency. So a lot of those things go into it. But again, as far as communication style, I think being straightforward and, you know, treating everybody as a professional, even when it goes down to extras, it's like, I can't tell you the number of times I've worked on shows. I've spent most of my career working as a second assistant director. Second ADs are generally responsible for doing call sheets, giving actors their calls, and doing the, you know, paperwork, production reports, and all those sorts of things at the end of the day. Second AD is generally responsible for working with background on set with the first AD, and being kind of the first AD's second hand person, right hand person on set. And I can't tell you the number of times that extras, who are invaluable to any production, if you don't have good extras and if they're not working well, it can ruin a shot. It seems like a lot of ADs don't respect what they do and feel the need to, or the whatever it is, to treat them poorly, yell at them and not tell them what's going on. But just like with any other crew member, the more they know about what you're trying to do, the better they're going to work for you. And if they feel you're including them in the process, and this, again, for extras or for the grip, you know, that's working a block away, rigging something, if they know that you're including them on the process, they're going to do whatever they need to do to get it done. And if you're yelling at them, it's, you know, why are we waiting on sound? It's like, why are you calling us out? You knew it was going to be a half hour setup. So all of those things, just communicate as you would with, you know, just be professional. That's my take on it. But again, there are plenty of ADs that don't have that style. And there are plenty of ADs that just can't do it that way, that they have to take control of things. And it works for some, it doesn't work for others. Same thing for some directors appreciate that and some directors don't. There'll be directors that really, really do not like when their AD is speaking above a certain level, yelling. I don't like yelling on my set. And those are things that they'll mention to the producers if it becomes an issue. So, but it's all, it's personalities. It's figuring out who you're working with. It's figuring out who you're dealing with. And, you know.
Yeah. There's a scenario that played out when I was on a film set once. I wasn't the assistant director, but it was a very small indie shoot and I was a producer and it was, so I was just trying to move things along. And, the director of photography on this project would say, how long does it take to set this up? And they would say, for example, 15, 20 minutes, but then it would really be like 45 minutes or an hour. And like right. That kept happening the entire day. And we right. were just like, hey, like, just like, if you need more time, like, just let us know. But they wouldn't right. do that. So I'm just curious to like these type of situations where we didn't like yell at him, but it was like deeply frustrating. Uh-huh. So I'm just curious to know how you would handle that, or what do you think a good way to handle that?
Well, sometimes you just need a different DP if they're not working the way you need them to work. Or if that's the case, if you know that's going to be, then you know, if I ask and he says 20 minutes, you know, it's going to be a 45 minute setup. And then you plan and then you figure maybe we can do something different. If it turns into an issue again, as a first AD, that's not really, it's not my job to say, we need to do, it's my job to go to the producers and say, he's giving consistent 20 minutes, setup times that end up being 45 minutes. I don't know that we're going to make our day. Then it's up to the producer to figure out what they're going to do about it. And as a first AD, that's kind of not my job. It's my job to say, this is what we're doing. How much time do you need? And if they're going to be wrong consistently in their estimates, that's for somebody else to deal with. Same thing happens if there's a makeup. This is one of my earlier shows. Every single day it was an issue because makeup and hair said they would need at least an hour and a half every day for this one particular actress. Every day she was consistently scheduled for an hour for makeup. So she was brought in an hour before they would need her for rehearsal. Invariably, she'd go for rehearsal and they'd say, okay, we're going to be ready in 20 minutes. Of course, now she's had an hour. She needs an hour and a half. And now you're 20 minutes away from rehearsal. So right there, they're building in not enough time. There was nothing right. I could do about it. As a second AD, I was like, well, this is what they're telling me. It always came to the producers coming down to the makeup trailer saying, why is this taking so long? And makeup was consistently saying, well, we told them it was going to take this long, but they're just not giving us enough time. That particular show happened the same sort of thing with the director of photography, who would say, yeah, 20 minutes. We'd say, okay, 20 minutes, 20 minutes later, we bring the cast back in. They do a rehearsal and you say, okay, I need another 20 minutes to tweak. So again, a 20 minute setup became 40, 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And you're losing time on the actors because they didn't get the time they needed. So now I think that's where it goes to making sure you've got the crew that you need together. And that's beyond what a first AD can actually deal with. But knowing all of those elements is something that's good to know. Something I've also found is that oftentimes when you go to a director of photography, I've always told people when you're covering set, don't ask how much time they need. Give a suggestion. Say, what do you think, 10 minutes? It should be an educated guess based on where they are in the process. But oftentimes, I think a director of photography will take as much time as you give them. So if you're going to say, do you think you can have this done in 15 minutes? They might say, oh yeah, sure, I'll be fine in 15. And then they can do any tweaking when actors are coming in or they're rehearsing, they can tweak as they go. But I think doing it that way, instead of saying how much time, saying, can we do this? It makes it all, back to that whole collaboration thing, It brings everybody into it and makes them a part of whatever it is you're doing. And it's a conversation instead of a, you know, a demand or just a, what do you need? What do you want? Because if they say, yeah, well, I need an hour, you might say, well, we don't have an hour. And then it's, you know, then it can come into, it can turn into a whole argument. So it's always nice to come into it, understanding what it is they're doing and trying to do. And then having your own sense of what that should take.
The same thing happens with a gaffer on a set that I was on. You know, she took about almost an hour to set up a scene at a doorway because she didn't have like the right filters or something like that. And it, it turned into a bit of a mess. So I think picking the right crew members is a good tip.
Right. And I mean, I was also going to say, because sometimes that it can also be that it, each department has their own issues. Like something happens with, you know, the cost, it didn't get sewn in time. So now we're waiting out. So everybody has their own things and you can't, it's almost like you have to recognize that and work with it.
Yeah.
Every, things are going to happen and you have to under, you have to go into it understanding things are going to happen. And the response shouldn't be to get pissed off at people about it. The response should be, okay, so what do we do? Or is there something else we can go to now if we're waiting on that? And making it, in, instead of blaming people or putting people under pressure for something that they're not necessarily completely in control of. The delivery was late. Who could, I can't necessarily control. Instead of blaming people for things like that, oftentimes it helps to bring them into the fold. So what can we do about that? And then, I mean, working on a set, you've got infinitely creative people who have infinitely creative ideas. And again, back to the hiring, that's what you're going for. You want people that are going to have their own ideas of how to do things. Even if I ultimately want you to do it my way, I would love for you to come to me and say, hey, this is my idea. Once I've decided this is what we're doing, you don't need to come to me with more ideas unless we actually need them. But you've got all those crew members there and you've got those people there with their experience and knowledge. And that's why you ideally have them. So when things do go wrong, you can come up with a solution fairly easily and without having to put anybody down or make them feel like, you know, I screwed up the whole day's shoot because I didn't have what we needed.
What are some misconceptions about ADs that you want to clear up?
Oh, I don't know that I care to clear any of it, but one of the big misconceptions I see of people that want to be assistant directors is they think it's a good way to become a director, which it's really not. It absolutely is possible to become director. My brother was a longtime first AD in New York, and he's just recently, for the past few years, been directing episodic. So I have a number of other friends who have been ADs and who've just started, you know, directing, because being in that position as a first AD right next to the director, especially if you're working on an episodic show, when you work with 5, 6, 7 different directors, you get a really good sense of what to do and what not to do. So it's almost like it's on the job training for being a director, but that's really not the career path. The career path is generally up. You start as a second AD, you move up to first AD, then to unit production manager. Those are all covered under the Directors Guild. And then maybe producing from there. So the career path is generally, if you're not going to stay as, I mean, there are plenty of people that stay as second ADs for their entire career. It can be a very lucrative thing if you can do it. And if you get on the right show, it can have just, you know, all the same benefits without a lot of the stresses that you need for being a first AD or a production manager. But if you are going into it and moving up the ladder, you generally don't move up into directing, you generally move up into producing. Something I've noticed is that a lot of ADs that do want to direct spend too much time thinking about that as opposed to the things that they're supposed to be thinking about, which are much more logistical. And it's like, if you're an AD and you really want to be on set watching, then you shouldn't be a key second AD, because a key second AD is generally, again, this is the way the hierarchy has sort of established itself traditionally, mm-hmm. although you can always change it. If you become a key second AD and you want to be the one that's on set you know, helping out the first AD, that's absolutely something you can do. But traditionally, it's the second that would be on set, and the key second that would be either at base camp, out at the trailer, keeping track of everything that's going on there, and keeping track, you know, dealing with the office production manager about things that are coming up, other things that are going on, if there are fittings that are happening. So it's a lot of stuff that they need to be thinking about. I don't know where we got in. So yeah, so like I was saying, if you get into working as a second AD, don't expect necessarily to be learning about what it takes to be a director. I think the best advice anybody ever said, I ever heard anybody say, was if you want to be a director, direct. So, in this day and age, it's really not hard to do. I think it's hard. It's hard to get yourself to do it and to figure out maybe what it is you want to do, but the materials are there. So it's like you can take your cell phone and make a movie if you wanted to.
How did you get your first TV job?
I went through the training program. Actually, I should also mention this. The training program is great. There's one in New York and there's one in Los Angeles. And they accept application. I believe it's like January is the application period. So it just passed. They're now selecting the class. But it's actually a great program. And it's dgatrainingprogram.org is the New York program. And the one in Los Angeles is trainingplan.org. And I would highly recommend, if you're thinking of being an assistant director, to look into it. You can absolutely work as a production assistant and get your days, or work as a non-union AD, third area. There are all sorts of restrictions about how to become a guild, a member of the Directors Guild, working as assistant director. And if you want to go that route, one of the possible avenues is through that program, if you can get in. There's a whole application and interview process, but if you get through it, it can be a great thing for a lot of people, especially ones that don't necessarily have that much experience, but really know that this is something that they can do, and that is like right up their alley. So what was your...
How did you get your first TV job?
How did I get my first TV job? I think it was with people I had worked with as a trainee, if I'm not mistaken. And that was one of the benefits of being in the training program. They assign you to shows. You work 50 days on one show, and then they move you on to another one. So I got to meet a whole bunch of different people that, once I was eligible to actually work as an AD, they were like, oh yeah, come work with us.
Can you talk more about your experience in the DJ trainee program?
It was interesting because it was, I had never done anything in film at all. I was a couple of years out of college, and sort of on a whim, I mentioned my brother got me into it, but sort of on a whim, he had been working for a few years as a production assistant on features in New York, and he was going to take the test for the program. So he suggested I do it. I drove down to Los Angeles, took the test, ultimately got into the program, again, with no set experience. I think the most time I had spent on set was that day I came down to take the test. I visited my brother on a set he was working on. And that was my first time ever on a set. So I really had no experience, no knowledge about what it was, which is why I say I kind of fell into it. I will say it was a great experience because it did introduce me to so many different styles of working. They tried to get me onto all different kinds of shows. So I was on, you know, I was on sitcoms, I was on 1 hour episodic shows, different style shows. I was on features. I got to travel out of town for features as a trainee. So all of those things kind of made it a really rich, I would say, and rewarding experience. I don't know that it's that way these days. This was a while ago. This was back in the 90s. Although I don't see why it wouldn't be, because the trainees I've met seem to have the same sort of sense that it's a great way to just introduce them to all different kinds of work environments and attitudes and personalities.
So can you talk about, I guess, like these days, how you let me say that again. So how do you find jobs these days, and like, yeah, how do you find work these days?
Yeah.
And what is like the interview hiring process like?
It's interestingly, things have changed a lot over the years. I think if you watch TV, you'll also notice that there are a lot of shows that'll come on for, they'll do their one season, especially with Netflix, with Amazon, with all of these outlets looking for content. It's almost like a hit or miss. It's become much more of a gig economy than it ever used to be. Years and years ago, you could get on a show, you work on the pilot gets picked up, and then the show would run for a few years and you'd stay on that for a few years. There are so many more of those kinds of shows than there are today, where they get a full 22. I think what SVU, Law and Order SVU, has just picked up for another 3 years. That's like one of the little 25-year series. Those don't happen really all that much anymore. That'll shoot for 10 months out of the year to keep you employed pretty much full time. And then when they end, you know they're coming back. So you take your 2 month vacation and then you know you're going back to that. In this day and age, that really doesn't happen that much anymore. And you'll also find that they'll shoot 6 or 7 episodes of a series, which will be 2 or 3 months out of the year, and not know if they're coming back, which means now I'm looking for work 5 times a year, as opposed to knowing I'm going to be working for 2 years at least. So it gets really high. I think the only strategy is just keeping in touch with people and just making sure people are still aware. Again, there's a certain level where, as an assistant director, you're often waiting for somebody to give you the job, as opposed to being the producer. And that's why there are a lot of ADs are moving up that route to become producers, because it's a lot more satisfying to be the one that's creating the work for other people than the one that's constantly looking for work, if that makes any sense. So there's no strategy other than just calling and keeping in touch with people and making sure that you're still out there. There's something someone once told me, it's not about who knows, it's not about who you know, it's about who knows you. You can know all the people in the world. If they don't know you, you're still never going to get a call. So it's just making sure that people know you and they're aware that you're out there and they're aware that this is what you're doing, which is also why it becomes difficult. If you're say an assistant director and you want to direct, it's difficult because people know you as what you are. So if I'm an AD, people aren't going to think of me as anything other than an AD. And if you want to be thought of as something other than that, then you can't be doing this, saying this is what I am. It's unfortunate, but that's kind of because of there are so many different specializations within a film crew, and kind of, I guess, within any industry, there's so many specific specializations. If you say this is what I specialize in, it's going to be hard to get people to even think of you as something else. So oftentimes you have to leave whatever it is to do that, which is, again, if you want to direct, don't go into ADing. Thinking that somebody will say, oh, hey, you're a great AD, let me hire you to direct. That rarely happens. If you're a great AD, I'm going to hire you because you're a great AD.
Yeah. Do you have to go in for an interview?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
What
absolutely.
Is that process?
Normally, it's just like any other interview. You'd go with a resume, you'd talk to a producer. Usually, it's and depending, again, on what the position is. If you're interviewing as a first AD, and if it's an episodic, then it will be producers and production manager that will bring you in and make their decisions. Sometimes in that episodic format, the producers are also directors, will also be directing some of the episodes. But for the most part, you're interviewing with producers. When it comes to features, oftentimes producers will line up. If the director doesn't have anybody they know or like, the producer will line up some interviews and it'll be just a same kind of interview with the director, producer, and first AD. And it's normally just talking through, just making sure, just seeing what they're capable of. Most resumes, film based resumes, are pretty much credit lists. with any, you know, special skills or special filming things that you're familiar with. So they know what you've worked on. So it's just a matter of, it often feels like more of a personality test to see if we get along. And if you like my style, same thing. Are you a yeller? Those are questions you might get. Are you a yeller? Or how do you run the set would be, or what's your strategy for motivating the crew are things that might come out in those kinds of interviews. And that would be for the first AD. For second ADs, again, it depends on the kind of, whether you're interviewing for key second or for second, the questions might be different, but it's always usually about your work style and how you like to communicate. And I think in my experience, again, it's like, I always look for people that are open to communication and are good at communication. And also know that this is what they want to be doing. It's like, if you go to a first AD interview and they say, where do you see yourself in 5 years? Oh, I see myself directing a bunch of feet. That's probably not the person they're going to go to right away, because I don't want a first AD that's thinking about directing so much. It's nice for a first AD to think about what the director needs and what the director is going to need. But as far as what is the director doing, that's not something I don't know. I think, does that make some sense?
Yeah, no, definitely.
For sure. Can you tell us a little bit about pay? Like, what should people expect for the various AD roles?
That is a loaded question. And there's a whole range, and it depends, okay, again, on whether it's union or non-union. Non-union, I don't know what you can expect or should expect, because it's pretty much open to whatever, you know, you're willing to do it for. Within the guild structure, there are low budget agreements where under a certain amount, under 500,000, say, it's negotiable. So as long as they cover pension and health, production covers that, you can get anything, they can pay you anything you want or anything they want. I would think there are also minimum wage laws that affect that. But basically you could work on a DGA project minimum wage if that's what was negotiated and if they're working under a certain tier. And all this information is available on the Directors Guild website. Also, if people are interested in figuring out how to work, how to make a show a union show, they've got agreements for all categories. But once you get in, I mean, it's, if you've been working, that's the other thing. It pays really well, but something to keep in mind is that you're not always working, and maybe half the time, or if not more, you're looking for work. So I think, like, the guild started, do you want specific numbers?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Well, for a DGA, second AD, it's something in the range of the weekly pay rate is something in the range of, I think it's like $3,200 a week right now. Key second is probably $300 or $400 more than that. But then there's also a production. So it can be very lucrative if you work all the time. But that's something else to just keep in mind, that working in any of these positions, you're always hustling for work and you're not necessarily working a full year. But if you can get on a series where they do 22 episodes, that's, you know, roughly three episodes, you know, 22 episodes is, you're working 10 months out of the year. Mm-hmm. You can make a sizable amount. But again, and that's for guild shows, features, that sort of thing. First ADs are up in the $4,000 range.
That's good to know.
But also it's also a really stressful job, because that's the other thing. You're
right.
You're basically paid for, you know, your hours that you're not going to get back. I think I always hear people say that the first AD or first ADs generally die before their time. It's like, because of the stress and because of the hours, a normal, you know, work week could be 70 hours, 80 hours easily. And that's not just sitting behind a desk. That's up and moving around. That's thinking. That's paying attention to things. That's all of that. So it can be extremely stressful, especially if you have a family. It can be you will never see your family. Oftentimes there are ADs that would have been divorced had they not been working, because they're away all the time. So they don't actually have a chance to to get into arguments and fights. It's like, it works better for them that way. My wife never sees me. So that's not me, but I've heard ADs, like, she never sees me, so she has nothing to get pissed off at. So I don't know. So it takes a toll.
Is there a difference with maybe like a half hour sitcom as opposed to an hour long program?
Just in the schedule. It's like an hour long programs. Traditionally, we took about 8 days to shoot. Now some of them do 7 days. And like all these little half hour shows, mostly are around, we'll do in a week. So I've been working on Mixed-ish for, you know, on and off for the past, this last season. And same thing, they're a 5 day shoot schedule. So 5 days prep, 5 days shoot. For a half hour.
What do you think keeps assistant directors going, being that, you know, it's kind of taking them away from the rest of their lives?
I honestly don't know what keeps me going. is it really bad of me to say that what keeps me going is the money? It's like part of it's the money, and it's something that I do well.
That's real.
I mean, when I do it, I enjoy it. So it's all of those things. It's something, there's something about getting it done that's really satisfying, especially when you look at a script that's a really challenging script. How are we going to get this done? And then you come up with a schedule that, hey, this actually makes a lot of sense. And then you do it and it works. It's like, holy, you know, it actually worked. There's something in that. Even beyond whether the project ends up being good or not. If I watch it and it sucks, who cares? I enjoyed doing it. And it was the process that I think there's that collaborative process that really makes it enjoyable, or has, at least for me. And I think that's what a lot of ADs also thrive on, that whole collaboration, bringing people together, leading the crew through the storm and ending up on the other side with a product that somebody can do with what they want. So there's all of that, but the money helps. And that's part of the reason why it's been hard I won't deny it's been hard to get out of it, because you get used to, you know, that and jumping to other things where you're working just as hard for less and without that reward of finishing the project. I don't know. That's my answer.
Awesome. Okay. Can you talk to us about the film scene in Atlanta and what it's like out there? And if you think that people still need to be in like the two major markets, i.e. New York and LA, to get into the business?
I think it's actually probably easier to get into it in Atlanta, because you've got a whole lot more people, it seems, doing their own thing. Doing a lot of indie, low budget things, more so than I think you would in Atlanta, in New York or Los Angeles. Also being a right to work state, Georgia makes it easier if you're not in any guild or union to sort of get involved and get into working on things and with people that can maybe teach you something. But it seems like it's almost like the community. I haven't been here that long. I've been over the past 3 years back and forth between Atlanta and Los Angeles. But the thing I've noticed about Atlanta is there are a lot more. There really are. It's almost like the film community is everywhere and everybody is part of it. It's, again, figuring out who the real ones are and who the fake ones are. And by that, I mean, the real ones are the ones that are saying, hey, this is what I'm doing, and they're actually doing it, as opposed to the ones that are saying, hey, this is what I'm going to do, and don't actually do anything.
it does seem like Atlanta is becoming like a new film mecca, especially with the studio that Tyler Perry just built. So I'm more will happen over time.
I'm curious to see what happens, because I also read that article about he doesn't have writer, he writes everything by himself, which I would think kind of shows. And it's one thing to have all these studios and to make all this work, but it doesn't necessarily help if you're not going to bring other people in to it.
Okay.
One of the big problems I think that Atlanta has right now is all the writers are still mostly in Los Angeles. So they write everything out there. And oftentimes they cast things from there. I can't tell you the number of shows I've worked on where they're always flying in guest cast, because everybody's cast out there. There are some that are cast locally, and there are like a certain segment that are cast locally, but still when Los Angeles is still kind of the main hub, especially for writers, if they could get some writers' rooms out in Atlanta, I think that would help. I don't know if there are any shows. I should actually look into that, and that's something I probably should know. And I apologize to any of you Atlanta writers who are here writing, but most of the writing rooms are still in Los Angeles. And that disconnect, I think, also makes it a little bit, that puts a little damper on the whole Atlanta film community as being a self-sustained hub of production. They could get writing here. I think that would be a huge, huge step.
Say New York kind of has the same issue to a degree. There are a few writers' rooms, but it's not as much as LA. So you have no choice but to move. Yeah.
Why did you move to it, or why did you start going to Atlanta?
Well, a number of reasons. One was just the cost of living in Atlanta is infinitely better than cost of living in Los Angeles, which keeps going up. I'd been getting calls about work in Atlanta more than Los Angeles, so I started sort of moving over this way while maintaining my, in the Directors Guild, you can work in a production center, which would be Los Angeles or New York, and if you live someplace else, that can also be a local location. So I can work in Los Angeles and Atlanta as a local, meaning they don't have to put me up, they don't have to pay extra for that. So part of it was just so that I'd be available to work in Atlanta also, because it seemed like that's where a lot of my work was coming from. Another reason was just to be closer to, I'm from New York originally, so my family's in New York. So just being on the East Coast makes it a little nicer for that. So those are the reasons, main reasons why.
What do you see in terms of your future professionally? Do you want to continue doing this? Do you want to transition into producing, kind of like what you were talking about before?
Yeah, I think part of my coming to Atlanta was with that in mind, that it seemed like it might be a little bit more a better place to seg into other aspects of filmmaking. Over the past couple of years, I've been an assistant director for, like I said, over 25 years, but within that time, I also do art, so I'm an artist. I've tried to maintain other interests, which is another thing that I would also recommend anybody that gets into this industry, try to maintain your other interests, partly because you never know when it's gonna stop. The writer's strike that happened several years back kind of brought production to a halt, and there were a lot of shows that went away and never came back. And I think that's part of the time, that's part of the period when Atlanta started rising up, when, because there were no writers, there were no shows going on. And then people started doing things. I think actually Louisiana, I think, came first. Shows started moving out of Los Angeles at that time because other people were wooing them in. I'm not sure how that all happened. But just having other interests is an important thing. So that's something I've always tried to maintain. So I do art, yes. I've production designed a couple of shows in that period, but I keep coming back to ADing in large part because it's the working with the whole of it, as opposed to specifics that I enjoy. But yeah, segging into producing is something that I think I would excel at and really enjoy, partly because I do like being that one to try to make sure people recognize what we're doing and bringing in the right people to do the right jobs. And just with all the people I know some really, really talented folks, and it would be fun to get them all together to work on a project. And that's something you can only really do as a producer.
What would you say your proudest moment on set is?
I don't get proud all that much. I don't know. It's simple things. Simple things like having the forethought or the foresight to plan for contingencies even when there was no reason to expect you would need one, if that makes sense. And I'm thinking back to a specific show I was working on where we were working and on the lot, the power went out. So all the productions on the lot were down for 2 hours because the power went out. But we had sort of worked out this where we were prepared for that. For whatever reason, we were prepared so that we had our own generators. We went out on the back lot and started shooting out on the street. We were the only show that was still working because we had thought these things through. And even though it was like, why would anybody consider that the power on Paramount would go out on all the stages? It turns out it was like there was a brownout in the city. So it was like a large portion of Los Angeles where the power went out, and we were the only production working just because. And that was, if there was any sense of pride, there was a sense of pride in having had that forethought, even though it wasn't necessarily something that would have, that should have been thought about. So I don't know.
And what about something that you learned in 2019? So you've been an AD for a while. What's something that you've learned in the last year or so?
You have to ask for it or you're not going to get it, because people won't just give you things for whatever, even if they love you. They're not just going to give you something if they don't know that's something you want. This is beyond AD work, but for anything, if you want it, you need to put it out in the world. Otherwise, it's going to feel like you're not getting anything, which you might not be, because people are out there and they're willing to help, but oftentimes they don't know you want the help.
Now, what about as an AD?
As an AD, I've learned that it's getting a lot harder to be an AD because I don't know that film schools even teach the importance of an AD and how that can help any kind of production. So I think I've learned that it's becoming a tougher sell as to why you should have a good AD. I think, and that's maybe it's become with a lot of these independent films coming up and people not really understanding what the specific job of the AD is, makes them not really think of it as something that they need or should have. And oftentimes it would be nice to have an AD, but we don't really need one. And it's like, well, you kind of should have one. Again, we talk about the compartmentalizing and of all the different jobs and positions, that one person has a lot of responsibilities that if somebody doesn't keep track of them, you can have problems. And especially in Atlanta, with Sarah Jones, the train accident that happened years ago, that absolutely is something that should have, and it did fall on the first AD.
What was that accident?
Forget what the show was, Midnight Rider. There was a show, they were shooting on a train trestle. The train came. No, but they didn't have permission. They were actually denied permission to shoot on the tracks. They decided to do it anyway. They had a hospital bed on a train trestle over the water. And had basically said to their PAs, when you hear the train, let us know. We'll have about a minute to get off the track. As soon as they heard the train, they had 10 seconds is what it seemed like. I mean, you can watch the video. It's like, if you go search it online. And one of the camera assistants was killed by the train because she couldn't get off the tracks in time. And that turned, there was a whole lawsuit about it. I'm sure people listening to this will have heard about that. But since then, there's been a real push towards set safety. And again, the first AD is really the you know, on-set safety officer, and responsible for those things and responsible for keeping track of those things, and should have said, if we don't have permission to be on the tracks, we're not going to be on the tracks. And that's something that, going back to what producers and production managers, directors can do to support. If a first AD says, we don't have permission to be on those tracks, we cannot shoot on those tracks, they should have been backed up by a producer, plain and simple, because especially you're talking about, we're making movies, we're making entertainment for the most part. Nobody should lose their life. Nobody should get hurt doing what we're doing. And if somebody does, then there's a problem, and we need to look at what the problem was. So, and in this case, it was just people not doing the right thing.
Would you recommend, as an indie filmmaker, would you recommend that I hire a second assistant director?
It depends on the show. It depends on the elements you have. A lot of independent shows don't have that much going on. If you're, you know, small cast, not too many locations, you don't necessarily need that extra, that other second AD. You know, if the first AD is in a contained environment, if we're shooting in an apartment with small cast, first AD can handle that on their own. And the second AD can handle base camp and getting the cast in on their own. When you start adding more elements, so, you know, have 10 cast members, start adding stunts and stunt doubles, the more elements you start adding and shooting on a location where we're outside, then you might want to add more of those. And again, when it's not contractually mandated, it is still always nice to have those extra bodies to do, to cover all of the responsibilities. Especially, yeah, if you're producing a show, it would be in your best interest to have the number of people you need to do all the work, so that either you're not stuck doing it at the end of the show, or you don't miss it. And when you're talking about like a lot of these indie non-union, again, it's the pay between a production assistant and a second AD, it might be the same thing. So it's almost like, but you would want to get somebody that knows what they're doing. And
can you tell us a little bit about the benefits of being a member of the guild?
Yes. Well, first you get paid better. Even on the low budget agreement shows, there is a certain guarantee. The guild has your back. As an AD, I've never felt like if there was an issue with a contractual issue with what a company was doing, I never felt that they would turn their back on me. The guild actually, when you start a show, you're supposed to report your work to the guild. And what they'll do is they'll check, make sure the company is signatory, first of all, so that you're not violating any guild rules. And they also make sure that there's money in the accounts, so that you don't start working on a show 3 weeks in, they say, sorry, we don't have any money to pay you. There's certain requirements that the guild has where they have to provide, the show has to provide. I actually kind of didn't know this until a show I was working on a couple of years back. I got a call from the guild saying, so we just wanted you to know that the company hasn't yet put this money into the escrow account, so you can still work on it, but we're warning you that they might not, and we'll let you know when that happens. So they actually called me and, you know, were very clear. They didn't want me to get screwed over, in effect. If you work on a non-union show and the producers say, oh, sorry, we ran out of money, that's it. You can take them to court if you want to, but that's your recourse. When you're working on a guild show, especially with these low budget agreements, they have to put a certain amount into an escrow account So you're kind of guaranteed to get paid at the very least. So that's one of the huge benefits. And they negotiate the contract, which is to work independently from show to show and have to negotiate your own contract every single time. I don't think that's something I would have been able to do. And I don't know that I would have been an assistant director if I had to do that and deal with money every single time. So having that, this is the base rate. This is the minimum they can pay. I'm cool with that. And I like having that already prepared for me. Additionally, you get, benefits, medical and health. If you work you have to earn a certain amount within a year to qualify, but you get covered by their insurance when you do, which is also a nice thing. So, and they have training. It's like they do try to keep you up to date with what's going on in the world. The networking is invaluable. Part of the one of the issues right now is there really isn't a huge Directors Guild organizational presence in Atlanta. New York, Los Angeles are always having events where, it's a great networking. It's a great way to network, but in Atlanta, not so much. And I don't know if that's ever going to change. Just having that group of people that's all within it is a nice thing.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Eric, this information has been invaluable. You were very thorough. So. Thank you again for joining the Black Film Space podcast, and we will see you on set.
Thanks for listening to the Black Film Space podcast. If you're interested in being part of our community and attending events, please visit us at blackfilmspace.com and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Black Film Space. Subscribe to our email list and podcast. All right, see you soon.